Good morning. 75 years is a long time to carry the memories of Pearl Harbor, and for Hawaii residents of Japanese ancestry, what came afterward? Today we'll hear two stories, a Hilo gas station attendant who wanted into the war following the attack, but who had to wait until FDR allowed the creation of the 442nd, and the story of a small girl who was sent with her family to a type of internment camp most people didn't know existed. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Nisei Veterans Memorial Center has extended belated recognition to the Japanese Americans who served in the military intelligence service during the war, and former Iran hostage Rocky Sickman, in town for today's ceremonies, remembers a harrowing time in our recent history.
It's Wednesday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. The conversation starts after these headlines.
And now, here is John Vandercook with further comments.
The reckless Japanese aerial attack on Hawaii this morning is still, from the tactical point of view, very hard to understand. Obviously, the high-flying Nipponese attack bombers took off from one or more of Japan's several existing great floating anti-aircraft carriers. Therefore, the bombing, though it has been severe, must be strictly limited in its possible immediate scope. That being the case, what in this incredible move have the Japanese attackers then hoped to accomplish? The dispatches tell us that Pearl Harbor, Hickam Airfield, and the city of Honolulu itself, with its 100,000 population, have all today been under scattered bomb attacks.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation, a bit of history that we got to hear just a moment ago. One John Vandercook, and clearly related to you.
Yes, my father was an NBC correspondent, and when the attack occurred, he had written a couple of books about Hawaii and had lived out here. And he was called upon to comment from the news desk about what the terrain was like at Pearl Harbor. But the report kind of shows what we knew and what we didn't know at the moment of the attack, which kind of fits into your opening story, doesn't it?
Well, this is true. There are things that we both have been talking about and many people have been talking about for years, and some things that even after 75 years keep coming out
of small
corners. Now, on the night of December 7th, 1941, Tomo Izumi was 8 years old and asleep with her five siblings in the family's home in Lapahoehoe. But it wasn't a night of sound sleep. Awakened by her father, a Buddhist minister, she and her family watched as he performed his own funeral. He believed he would be shot after being taken away that night. Now 83, Tomo Izumi wants everyone to know what really happened to the family and about a type of internment camp few knew existed.
The FBI just knocked on our door December 7th, that night. And my father, being a Buddhist minister, and he thought, what's going to happen to us aliens who are in this country? So when the FBI showed up, he thought that they were going to just line them up and just ready and fire and shoot them. So he told them, please wait in the living room. He woke up me, my sister and brother above me, and he held his own funeral. And that's why I think more than the other families whose fathers, they thought they were going to be questioned and sent home, yes, wore just sweaters over their pajamas and went for questioning. But they never went home until after the war. But my father, because he thought he was going to be dying that night, he changed into his suit and he took all his robes and everything. So we thought that maybe he's dead, you know. I, as an 8-year-old, I always wondered whether he was alive or not until we were allowed to visit him at Kilauea Military Camp, simply because he performed the funeral. The FBI didn't say anything. They just said, follow us.
So what happened after he disappears?
It was until 1942 in August. They gave us 2-day notice, and they said, your father is going to be sent to Japan. Would you like to go with him? And of course, my mom said yes. So 2 days, she had two ladies come over and help her from the church to pack everything, get rid of things, and burn all the things that pertain to Japan. And we met the other families at Hilo Pier, and we went to Honolulu, and we got on this ship, and we went to San Francisco. That's where the FBI joined us, as far as I know, because you can't escape from a ship. And none of us even thought of escaping because We wanted to see our father again and join him. But the FBI agents, three of them, got on the train with us, and they're very nice to us. Yeah. We made one stop in Chicago. We were told this was Chicago station. Please pull all the shades down so that the people don't know that there were Japs in the train, because we were considered enemies. Maybe the train might get derailed, so don't peek out. But, you know, that the FBI agents that were with us were nice. They never called us Japs again. Only at that time, and that's when we first knew that it might be dangerous. They treated us good, I think, because they wanted those Axis countries to treat their American prisoners good.
When did you see your father again?
We met our father in Crystal City, Texas, where they had built a camp out of the desert there. We found out after we met him that he was in Oklahoma and Louisiana in the Army. And then he went to the camp in 1943 before we got there in May.
And how long
Crystal
were you
City.
There? How long
we were there till December of 1945. The camp was really, you know, although behind barbed wires, they more or less kind of left us alone. And I didn't hear of anything really bad like escaping or people shot or rioting or things like that. We had three schools, Japanese school, German school, and English school. And being that the group that was to be repatriated to Japan, most of the parents sent us to Japanese school. Very regimented. We had to get up every morning at 6 o'clock. The bugle would sound throughout the camp, and we would get up and go to the school grounds by 6:30 and lined up in our grades. And first thing the teacher would say is to turn towards the east and bow to the Emperor of Japan. And then we would have 1 minute of silent prayer for the Japanese soldiers that died in action. And on good days, we would jog around the Japanese section of the camp to build our bodies, I guess, to be healthy and not be a burden when we go back to Japan.
Was there any of relationship with the other camps? You mentioned that there were German prisoners there.
I'm pretty sure that some of the teenagers became friends, Germans and Italians, but we were kids and we usually played among ourselves, classmates and friends and Girl Scouts. We had a Girl Scout where we marched and did sort of like ROTC, build up our bodies again, twice a week. With Japanese military commands, in Japanese. Everything was sort of regimented by our teachers and parents because we were quite independent American citizen kids.
It's kind of confusing because some people hear you say that you were American kids. At the same time, you were also Japanese kids. In your mind, which one were you?
Well, when I was willing to learn and do, I guess I was trying to be Japanese. But when I rebelled silently without talking back, unwillingly getting up and going for those exercises, I was still an American. I was brought up very Japanese style by my parents in America. But at school, I'm totally American. So, I can't say. I really can't say, yeah.
Was this a part of your life that you truly had to make peace with?
Yes. Well, my father, being a Buddhist minister, really believed in karma, that what happens to you is because you are the cause. The Americans would say you reap what you sow. So he never showed any bitterness. He just told us to persevere and do the best we can. So to tell you the truth, I enjoyed playing with new friends from the mainland. and going swimming in the pools that the Italian internee designed, and the fathers, the Germans and Japanese, all got together and built a real big pool for us.
Did you ever wonder why you didn't go after you had been told you were going to be sent to Japan?
Two shiploads did take, the families from the camp back to Japan, Germany, and Italy, I suppose. But twice our name was not on the list. When the war ended, we were still in the camp. They did give us a choice. You can choose to go back to Japan, or you can go back where you came from. My father decided to go back to Hawaii.
And you've been here all of these years since. Have you seen a different way in which people approach the Second World War, and in particular, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, in all the years that you've been living here?
Well, I visited Pearl Harbor, of course, the Arizona, and it just gave me a very sad and solemn feelings. So many young people and soldiers who want to defend their own countries have to die, But I think now that there's a bit more understanding and people trying to live in peace,
Tomo Izumi is now 83 and still lives in Honolulu. She worked in the Queen's Medical Center ER for 25 years and raised a family. She also wanted to be sure that history of the effects of Pearl Harbor in Hawaii and in the U.S. were accurately reflected, and in her family's experience in the days and years afterward. Her book is The Crystal City Story, One Family's Experience with the World War II Japanese Internment Camps.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15, and coming up, secret heroes of the Second World War. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about the day that Japanese air bombers targeted military installations at Pearl Harbor and elsewhere, killing 2,400 and wounding around 1,300. The Day of Infamy left the island of Oahu picking up the smoldering pieces of their lives, certain that America had entered the war. News of the bombing of the naval base must have caused a stir among residents of the U.S. territory's other islands, all islands except the forbidden Isle of Niihau. This privately owned island sees little of modern conveniences. The island, devoted to preserve pre-contact language and culture, has no running water or electricity. Niihau's isolated residents would not have heard about Oahu's tragic events. That didn't stop this date's newsmakers from coming to their shore, however. Things turned out quite differently for Pearl Harbor's attackers this time around. Can you give us the fate of the airborne assailants who landed on Niihau? You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the HPR prize.
In many ways, America's military was caught flat-footed by the Pearl Harbor attack, and the need to gather intelligence about the Japanese Empire and the need to monitor and understand its radio transmissions became an immediate priority in its aftermath. Only recently have historians been able to tell us much about the accomplishments of Japanese Americans in the military intelligence service, whose language skills were essential to the conduct of the war in the Pacific. The Nisei Veterans Memorial Center exhibit, MIS, America's Secret Weapon, Japanese Americans in the Military in World War II, is a revelation to most of us, and the center's executive director, Deidre Teagarden, is on the line to tell us about it. Good morning, Deidre.
Good morning, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Pleasure to have you. Those who took part in the military intelligence service were sworn to secrecy about what they were doing, right?
Indeed. It wasn't until the 1970s that the veil of secrecy was really lifted and people were able to start talking about the wartime achievements of the military intelligence servicemen.
We would have been pretty well lost without them in terms of knowing what the, you know, what we were hearing when we intercepted radio transmissions, right?
Truly. I think General MacArthur had said, you know, never in military history did an army know so much about the enemy prior to actual engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And this group of, you know, soldier linguists used their understanding of Japanese language, the culture, you know, not only to, as you said, you know, crack the code and translate captured documents, but they were also very involved with flushing out the caves, and they played a very crucial part in the rebuilding of Japan. So they have quite a history.
MacArthur himself had a pretty good understanding of the Japanese military character as well, so he was able to, able to make really good use of the intelligence he received. But before December 7th, 1941, we didn't know all that much, did we?
We didn't. We really didn't. And the MIS language school had actually opened in November of 1941 over in San Francisco. So we had members who were already, in the military intelligence service, learning Japanese. You know, most of the veterans, or most of the MIS members, of course, were AJA, Americans of Japanese ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few Caucasians as well, but it was primarily the Nisei. And, of course, Pearl Harbor happened, the MIS language training certainly intensified, and I think they cut the training program from 1 year down to 6 months, and it was just very, very intensive.
So obviously native speakers are those who learned, you know, growing up in America through their parents, were at an enormous advantage and much needed, yeah?
Very, very needed. I think it was Major General Charles Willoughby who had said that thanks to the Nisei MIS, they saved over 1 million lives and really shortened the war by 2 years with their abilities. And, you know, from Maui, we had over 220 MIS veterans that were part of the MIS.
When the AJAs came into the military in this function, were they trusted?
You know, they were not, and not totally. I don't want to give a sweeping generalization, but you know, Lloyd Kitaoka, who's actually the executive president of the 100th Infantry Battalion veterans there in Honolulu. His father was Judge Takashi Kitaoka, originally from Hana. And while he was not in the MIS, he said, the father, Judge Kitaoka, said that the words that Harry Truman said when he was giving out citations to the men who had fought, he said, you know, you fought not only the enemy on the battlegrounds, but you fought prejudice here at home, and you won. And it was thanks to the MIS, the 442, the 100th, and all these Nisei veterans that really changed the mindset, you know, and they had a core list of values that they worked by, you know, courage, honor, leadership, love of your family, making sure you honor your family. And they were some of the most decorated members from the war. And they didn't let anything stop them. They proved their loyalty over and over, and we are so thankful for their service.
And yet we understood so little about our Japanese citizens prior to the war, didn't we?
Indeed. And then, of course, when the incarcerations happened, you have these these young men who had to make the decision between being loyal to their country or being loyal to their family, and it was a very hard decision for some of them, I'm sure. We have a story. Hoichi Bob Kubo was a member of the 100th, and he was from Lahaina and was part of the MIS. And one of his jobs was he was a cave flusher, and in Saipan, he came across a cave. There were 122 Japanese civilians and 8 enemy soldiers inside. And of course, Japanese propaganda at that time was saying, if you get caught by the Americans, horrible things will happen to you. But he was able to use his language skills and his compassion. He shared his food with the people in the cave, and after an hour, he was able to save all those people by having them exit the cave. But it was all, it was his ability to understand Japanese and to be able to talk to the people and, let them know that while he was an American, he also had ties to Japan, and I think that combination saved many people, and he did the same in Okinawa. And in the end, he was awarded with the Distinguished Service Cross, and he was the most decorated MIS soldier in the Pacific. So there are so many stories like that where people were able to use that connection with home.
It's a great overarching story as well, Deidre.
It really is.
Thanks
so
much.
And there are so many stories, and I think that's what we try to do here at the Nisei Veterans Memorial Center, is share those stories and have people come in one-on-one and be able to read those stories.
Well, Deidre, we have to go. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Deidre Teagarden is the executive director of the Nisei Veterans Memorial Center, whose exhibit, MIS, America's Secret Weapon, Japanese Americans in the Military in World War II, runs until January 31st at its education center on Gopher Broke Road in Kahului, Maui.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Maurice Davis of Sumter, South Carolina, Hillary Brune Okamura of Honolulu, and Terry Jacobson of Kekaha for their recent membership gifts. Thank you to all of our listeners for your generous support.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club with Henry Kapono Presents, Back in the Day, the songs of CNK in 2 shows nightly, on stage now through Saturday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
A Capitol Hill forum on the fishing industry this week brought blistering criticism from Hawaii and mainland activists with what emerged as the reality check. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We've talked about this a lot since the AP report came out in September, and we've heard sometimes conflicting reports about what really happens on these ships. Was anything different at yesterday's Capitol Hill forum?
Well, a couple of things. We actually had a reporter in the room there in D.C., Kirsten Downey, for Civil Beat, and you used the word blistering. That's a good way to put it. The conditions that were described, I'll just share some of the descriptors: tragic, gruesome, brutal, even unconstitutional. This, of course, applies to foreign crews that are working on Hawaii-based longline fisheries, fishing for tuna. And that, I would say, is probably not new. But certainly they did address things that they could be doing. At least one official, a former State Department official, he's now at Georgetown, specializes in human trafficking. He said it seemed that the government, Hawaii officials included, seemed to favor fish over human dignity. That's essentially how he put it. And that even went so far as to say that the government officials are apathetic and even complicit in this slave-like situation, as it has been described by some reports.
What did he give as evidence of that?
Well, he shared the evidence from the AP report, of course, which was quite extensive. The challenge, as one person in the industry who defended the system, as you might imagine, saying things are not as bad, we're looking into it. The problem is nobody actually knows what happens when the boats go out to sea. You know, unless you have monitors on that, there's a lot of mystery as to what really goes on. And then the fact that you have foreign crews that are not protected by U.S. labor laws and protections that we have in our own statutes, that's something that makes it harder to prosecute. Catherine Jian from Hawaii was actually one of the people testifying, and as you know, she's fought against human trafficking, a number of causes, and she said she wasn't sure whether people could even prosecute these cases. It's difficult to get a hold on exactly what's happening.
So it seems that we're having a bigger conversation, but the same conversation that we've been having right now for a while. So where does it go from here?
We'll see. The forum yesterday was not an official congressional hearing. The Republicans are in control, but it did have a lot of government officials on hand, Justice Department, NOAA, the Labor Department. So hopefully raising awareness is going to be something that we can do going forward. There's another thing we can do, and Catherine Jian actually suggested this. You could stop eating fish. You could stop eating ahi and boycott these practices. As you might imagine, the head of the fishing industry said, no, don't do that. You'd be punishing a lot of people that really are not guilty in this, but that certainly is an option to send a message that we will not allow this. Having said that, of course, ahi at New Year's is a very precious thing here in the islands, and that might be a difficult one to swallow.
So we'll see which way people go, whether they start to, you know, vote with their wallets and not purchase ahi, or whether they'll make an exception. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a Civil Beat Reality Check. And, of course, in today's news, a lot of stories about the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, in December of 1941, William Thompson was a young man recently out of high school and working in a Hilo gas station. He later entered the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, created by the Roosevelt Administration for American citizens of Japanese ancestry. It became one of the most decorated units of its size in history. Today, William Thompson is one of its few survivors. We've talked over the past few years, but until we sat down this week, he'd never shared the story of how he went from a kid working at that Hilo gas station with no radio on an infamous day to a tech sergeant with something to prove in the 442nd.
It was early in the morning at the service station. We could see the police cars and other cars speeding back and forth, and we were wondering, must be something big to cause all that traffic. We didn't have a radio on, but later on we did find out from the radio that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. The owner came down and said that we'd have to close the service station. I guess at that time gasoline, your fuel like that had to be saved, so I guess they closed all the service stations that day.
As you were a very young man at that point, you'd only been out of high school for 6 months or so. What happened between the time that the service station closed and then you decided that you would go off to war?
Yes. By the time the executive order from President Roosevelt came out, I was employed at the Hawaii County. And they were doing work for the military. We got the word that AGAs, our enemy alien status, would be taken off and we could go off to war, just like any other young citizen.
When you went off to war, did you feel equal to any other American GI?
It was a challenge. When Roosevelt allowed the 442nd Regimental Combat Team to be formed, it was a challenge that if we were Americans, which we claimed to be, that we would be given a chance to defend our country. And I think that's the background for most of us. if they ask me why I joined, I would say, well, my buddies were all joining too, so I want to be with them. I think we felt that we were equal in certain cases because we were from one community. We knew each other. I think we felt a little more confident. What we did was more or less to stay alive. We had to do our best on the battlefield. We had good officers that I would say were true leaders. We were very fortunate in that we started gaining a reputation of being a crack military outfit. And I get this because the 442nd, most of us came from Hawaii. We knew each other either through relationship or by school, comradeship. So we were, I'd say, a very close-knit outfit. In a way, having been given the challenge and then having others say that we were very successful. We had generals. We even had a division thanking us for what we did. It was what we were trying to do when we went off to war. At that time, we were young. This was like, I think Dan Inouye called it, that we were on a great adventure. And that's how we looked at it, that it was a new experience for us. We were, you can say, like behind the eight ball because of the our ancestry background. But we wanted to do our best. Our parents, close friends would say, do your best. Don't bring shame on your country or your family. And I think this is what was our guiding style, guiding principle, is that we're not going to bring shame to our family or to our country or to our Japanese community. You know, one thing about our boys, one of the big things we did, and we didn't know what we were doing at that time, was in that last battle we had in Italy, we were attached to the 92nd Division. The 92nd Division was, at that time, they called the colored troops or the black. They were the African-Americans. The division had three regiments. Their performance was so poor, they were reduced to one regiment. And the challenge before the 92nd, the African-Americans, to prove themselves that they could be good frontline soldiers. But because their leaders were all suddenness to begin with, they were treated, you know, they were picked and jeered. Instead of encouraging them, they kind of kept pushing down the African-American. They thought they were only good as truck drivers, you know, service employees. But in a way, when we were attached to them, they were facing a tall mountain with the enemy shooting big guns down at them. Naturally, they couldn't proceed. They couldn't attack and get rid of the enemy on the high ground. Now, when the 442 joined them, our officers developed a very unique plan. The enemy was on a high mountain. One side was almost a sheer cliff. Our officers decided that we would climb the cliff and get behind the enemy. And that's what we did. We got rid of the big guns that were stopping the 92nd Division soldiers. Once we got rid of the big guns, they could go all the way, and they finally proved themselves that they could be frontline soldiers too. And I think that's one of the reasons why President Roosevelt said that there would be no segregation in the Army after that. That means the African-American now could serve in any category of the military, they would not be discriminated against and just be considered as menial laborers. I think that was one of the biggest things the 442nd did. We didn't know what we were doing, but that's how it turned out to be.
William Thompson is the president of the 442nd Veterans Club. He says his biggest fear is that after his generation fades, people will forget the 442nd and its victories on the battlefield and in the changing of mindsets of other Americans.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. It's been said, because of the incredible rate at which technology is developing, by the time you finish your education, much of what you have learned will be obsolete. To make this situation even tougher, many schools can't afford to buy the tech equipment students need to achieve any technology training. This issue is creating a gap between students who have access to the equipment and those who do not. To help close the gap, the Stupski Foundation gave PBS Hawaii $2.1 million to fund their student-driven program, Hikino. This is a PBS Hawaii learning initiative that mentors middle and high school students across the state. The kids learn to create professional quality video stories, which are assembled into a weekly show and broadcast statewide. In addition to technical skills, the kids are learning to think critically, to communicate effectively, and a host of other things needed to survive in the 21st century. You can find these student-produced programs at PBS Hawaii's website. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Hola, my name is Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii. You are tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line, and Bert, this looks like an intersection between old and very new technology, yeah?
Well, you know, we've had both of, the Polynesian voyaging society as well as the robotics, various robotics programs on the radio, but we've never had them on at the same time. And what's interesting is that PBS is definitely incorporating technology, because even on the worldwide voyage, there was one of the canoes was pretty heavily laden with technology that allowed them to do a lot of streaming of actual content that was taken at on the voyages. But they're also teaming up with this group called RoboNation, and they're going to be getting involved with some robotics underwater. Well, actually, ocean-based robotics. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking about those competitions that are actually coming up this month.
There's a lot that they've been able to learn using submerged robotics, yeah?
Well, so there's underwater robotics, and I think one of the competitions does involve underwater robotics, but they're also doing some, I guess, onboard vessel robotics. So we're going to be talking about what kinds of ships they're actually going to be using for this competition.
Sounds pretty good, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m. Today's Backyard Quiz. Today's date carries echoes of both shock and indignation 75 years after. The unprovoked air attacks seared the image of a nation wounded into the minds of a nation, and the residents of Niihau continued in the ways of prior to European contact, did not get news of the bombings by radio or newspaper. They were surprised to encounter one of the belligerents of December 7th up close and personal. No bombs fell from the Niihau sky, but it was a plane that dropped onto the sands below, crash landing in what was believed to be by the Japanese to be an uninhabited island. Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service pilot Shigenoro Nishikaichi was able to take some hostages with the assistance of three locals of Japanese descent on the island. Eventually, as time and fatigue caught up with the pilot, Ben Kanahele and Ella Kanahele overcame and killed their captor, and Ben was wounded in the process. He would later be awarded with the Medal of Merit and the Purple Heart, although his wife did not receive any official recognition.
And Albert Smith called us from Kaunakakai and knew that answer and will be receiving the prize. That is the quiz for this day. If you've got one for us for a future show, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:47.
Aloha, I'm Brandy Nalani McDougall, Professor of Indigenous Studies in the American Studies Department at the University of Hawaii at Mauna. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
One of the attendees at today's Pearl Harbor ceremonies is Rocky Sickman, who was serving as a U.S. Marine at the American Embassy in Tehran, Iran, in 1979, and was one of the 52 Americans taken hostage for 444 days. The Iran hostage crisis was front-page news for all that year, but it's perhaps too little remembered these days. Rocky's story of his ordeal is a reminder of the reasons we should never forget the sacrifice that put us where we are today.
I never realized I would ever be in a major historical event as the Iranian hostage crisis, which really put our nation at silence for over 444 days.
Yeah.
Myself, it was definitely the most difficult time of my life, being tied to a chair for the first 30 days, not allowed to speak. And the only thing I could think of those first 30 days, Chris, was the Vietnam War. It was 79, and the Vietnam War had just ended, and guys were coming home, but nobody remembered them. Nobody cared about them.
Yeah.
And here I was in a foreign country 10,000 miles away from home, and as I was sitting tied to a chair in a corner of a room through the broken windows, I could hear the noise of the capital of Tehran, how people would get up in the morning and the traffic would start from nothing to a loud noise, mm-hmm. and then it would slowly die down each day. And I'm sitting there tied to a chair thinking that the world's going on without me and nobody cares. Nobody remembered the Vietnam War veterans. So it was a very lonely time. And then that first Thanksgiving, first Christmas, we thought humanitarian gestures. And I was in a room with two other people. So the morning of November 4th, I see you. I don't see you again until January 20th, 1981, because we were all separated. After being tied to the chair, we were then locked in a room for the next 400 days. We went outside seven times out of 444 days. And you really learn a lot about yourself. And as we were talking earlier about some of the political prisoners that they would bring in, and they'd try to get us to make derogatory statements about our government. And then they would role play. And my worst situation when I was held hostage, Chris, was when they came in and took us from our room. Even though we were locked in a room and we knew where the restroom was, you had to put a piece of paper underneath the door and you knock on a door and the guard would come to open the door and blindfold you to take you to the restroom. If you knock too loud, they'd tell you you have to wait. So you had to do it in a can in your room. Mm-hmm. Well, this night, they came in, burst open the door. They were masked. Rifles were drawn. And they pulled us out. We thought it was a rescue operation, and they knew about it because they always told us if they ever come, the United States came to rescue, we would shoot you before they get to us. So you're sitting there thinking that this is it, you know, and you hear one of the commanders, the American commanders, hey, if you hear the helicopters, go for it. And all of a sudden they grabbed me and they put me into a room. And just 2 weeks prior, they had shown this revolutionary video of three individuals taken into a courtyard, turned, stripped, nude, and shot in the back of the head. Well, here they go putting this through this mock firing squad. And it was the most difficult time of my life. But I've used that, Chris, after coming back after 444 days, that believe it or not, I was a very shy individual growing up. And that basically, it either makes you or you breaks you.
Sure.
And I have been always able to use that as a stepping stone, saying, if I could make it through a mock firing squad, I can make it through anything. And then to come to find out, Chris, that eight people lost their life trying to come over to rescue. I don't know if you remember the rescue operation, Operation Eagle Claw.
Yeah.
And
Choppers in the desert.
Yeah, the helicopter and the C-130 collided.
Yeah.
And eight people lost their life. And here I'm able to come home January 20th after, I don't know if you remember, why the hostages?
All too well, Rocky.
Yeah. The United States government paid $8.3 billion to release 52 hostages.
And, well, Rocky, given that this is a story that perhaps not enough of Americans would remember,
right?
Why is it important to relive memories like that, like Pearl Harbor, like the Vietnam War?
Yeah, it really goes back into my mission that I'm doing here today.
It's Folds of Honor.
Folds of Honor, yeah. But I wanted to continue on, and Dan Rooney, the founder of Folds of Honor, heard I was retiring, and he said, Rocky, you got to come work for me. And it was one of those things that, you know, I'm 59, I'm an old guy now, Chris, and but it was something that I will never forget, those eight people that gave up their ultimate sacrifice, their life, to allow me to regain my freedom. People forget what freedom's all about. It's not free. And people have lost their life to continue to fight for it and give up for it. So Folds of Honor provides scholarships to families of fallen and also their dependents and also families of the disabled. And so it is something that, as military men and women, there's also the families. Chris, and I don't know if you have children. My poor parents had to go through 444 days, each morning waking up not knowing.
And during the hostage crisis, we really didn't know if you guys weren't going to be executed the next day.
That's what my parents were going through. And so the families of the military that are currently, you know, serving, less than 1% of our population is serving the war on terrorism. And so we should not only not forget about the military men and women, but we should not forget about the families. And so that's where Folds of Honor really comes here. And my drive is to really help educate people about Folds of Honor, which, again, provides scholarships to families of fallen and also disabled.
I saw a video recently of military personnel walking into an airport, and the people in the airport stood up and applauded them.
Yes.
And I couldn't help thinking that would not have happened in the Vietnam years.
What a shame that is. And, you know, what's really interesting is the number of Vietnam veterans that now continue to make sure that the troops that are currently serving do not get treated like what they were treated.
It has gotten better.
My gosh, yeah. And it's because, and interesting enough, when we came home, 52 men and women, you know, were stripped of freedom, dignity, and pride. And after 444 days, we come home to ticker tape parades in New York. We didn't want that. I mean, but people were reunited for 52 people. 52 people were killed the first minute of the Vietnam War. Nobody remembered those people, but, you know, for some reason, people remembered the Iran hostage crisis. And after that, I mean, we got really criticized a lot. And I could understand why we were criticized, because a lot of people were very upset that we got what we did and they got nothing. But interesting enough, right after that, Chris, 1983 is when the Vietnam Wall started to be built.
Yeah.
Because we realized what we did not give, we took that and we built what should have been built years earlier, the World War II wall, Korean, you know, the Vietnam wall. And so because of that, it's sad that so many men and women probably went to their grave with never getting a thank you, is what they should have gotten.
But, you know, this Pearl Harbor Day, it's a new day. We have a chance to really change our thinking, don't we?
Absolutely. You know, what happened there, the history, and I think every young boy and girl that's in school should, you know, understand and learn about the history and learn about not only was it the men and women, that, what they went through, but the families of what everybody went through. And my Pearl Harbor Day was Iran, you know, and there's different events that we should never forget what formed our country and the sacrifices that people did give to provide us the freedom that we basically have. And that's why my journey, it's just a great opportunity of honoring their sacrifice and educating their legacy of the children and the families of those military men and women.
Rocky Sigmund served as a U.S. Marine at the American Embassy in Tehran, Iran in 1979 and was among of the 52 Americans taken hostage for 444 days. He's in Hawaii to represent Folds of Honor, a nonprofit organization that provides educational scholarship assistance to spouses and children of fallen or disabled service members. The organization has provided more than 10,000 scholarships, and you can learn more about Rocky and his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. A day of powerful memories.
And we heard many of them. And there have been other stories throughout the HPR newscasts and others that we hope will come out. But I was so struck by what William Thompson told me yesterday as we were going out and I was waiting for his son to pick him up. And he said, you know, really, truly, my biggest fear is that the world will forget.
Well, that's the fear of a lot of people because we really can't repeat some of these lessons.
One would hope not. But that's going to do it for us for our part of Pearl Harbor Day today. Many more activities and events that will be covered throughout the day, and we hope you'll stay with us for that. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to continue our Last Job in Hawaii series with Dr. Jim Barhall. We'll be talking about telemedicine and what that means for Hawaii, and it's a double-edged sword.
And we'll kick off a holiday music series with the music of Escargot. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call us on our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or reach us via Twitter at HI Conversation, or BKOZHPR.
We know that most people can't listen to the entire show, so if you ever want to hear parts of it that you missed, you can find those and other shows, too, on the archive at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.